every social media platform should have some, you know, standard toxic or some flag if information is actually true or not. And that those are all industry specific. Manufacturing, public, private sector, education, each has their own various domains that should be governed.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders, government officials, and leaders of advocacy groups. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Ari Kaplan with us today. Ari is the head evangelist for Databricks, a leading data and AI company. He was also the global AI evangelist for DataRobot. I invited him on this show as it is very important to get different perspectives towards framing AI legislation, and we need to get the perspective of industry. Welcome, Ari. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Sanjay, so nice to be here. I've been a big fan of everything you've been doing with the podcast and also, you know, as president or on the board of different government, India and U.S. relationship. What you've been doing over 20 plus years has been tremendous.
Thank you, Ari. President Biden announced a sweeping executive order on October 30th, and now we have the EU, which has announced the AI Act. Give us your perspectives on both of these pieces, one an executive order and one a potential legislation.
Yeah, well, first of all, I've been through every single administration, big advocate for truth, for transparency. And as the world changes and technology changes, we must stay on top of all of this policy making. And of course, it goes beyond the White House to every branch and then internationally as well. Many years in the making. The last company you had mentioned, DataRobot, I had a podcast. We had Will Hurd, who was a representative at the time, come on. And it was like a really bipartisan effort, since from the U.S. perspective, we want to ensure safety and security, developing standards for how the U.S. should handle things. But then also there's, from a competitive standpoint, intellectually, you don't want to fall behind, but also from a security standpoint, there are other countries you want to stay on top of or stay ahead of from that information security standpoint. So many years in the making. I appreciate that there was a lot of input from all different types of people, sectors, education, public, private sectors, thought leaders, tech leaders. I'm sure I'm missing a bunch. So that I think is very important, since everyone has their own perspectives and pulling it together. Hopefully the best ideas rise to the top. But yeah, there's, from the safety perspective, there's safety of our defense. There's safety for our infrastructure. The Defense Production Act, for example, for disclosing when things in data and AI might potentially cause a threat, then security. We'll get into the practicality of that, but securing data has always been a concern with the HIPAA, GDPR, and then internationally. But with AI, totally changing like everything. It's another layer that needs to be transparent and understood and non-black boxed out. I'm very much in favor of the executive order, with also the point that things are changing so quickly. A year and a half ago, there was no LLMs there were, but it wasn't like mainstream. And a year or two or three from now, there's going to be the next couple of levels. We need that ongoing. I was pleased to see this progress. I read through it all and it all seemed to make sense.
Databricks is a global company. The EU AI Act obviously has taken precedence. They just went through it and I think it'll go through the parliament and should be effective in 2025. Now, we obviously in the US are in an election year. It doesn't seem like we probably are going to get comprehensive legislation. Is there a concern that the EU is ahead and companies need to adhere to it, that it might stifle innovation in the tech industry?
Yeah, great question. And then from in terms of opinions, like the opinions that I give are more my own than an official Databricks standpoint. But yeah, there is absolute concern. You don't want to fall behind. But then it's also an opportunity when other countries or European unions set a precedent first. That could be very good. It could be something that you copy the best ideas from and bring it over. Or if you see it fall short or you see there's a backlash, or you could let other people do the test forward. But in these days, things are happening so quickly that every quarter, every couple of months could, depending on the situation, could make you lagging. And at some point, innovation happens so quickly that multiple months could be a big challenge.
So you just talked about how things are moving so quickly. Just as you said, there were LLMs a year ago, multimodal agents, super agents, maybe AGI. How does Washington or Brussels keep pace with the fast pace of this technology and the legislative framework that needs to be done? How can we do that? Because in Washington, we don't do quick.
Yeah, great question. By the way, I did a bunch of federal consulting back when I was with Oracle, Department of Defense, all different branches. So I've experienced a lot of that. I've experienced the slowness at times, so much so that I even asked some folks, if we are, God forbid, in a war and you want to do a change, like add a column on a table and it takes a week, like how can you react? And oh, when different times they go through different emergency protocols. But I think involving tech leaders in a lot of the decision makers is key to that gap that you see. If I were a legislator or if I were in public affairs, I'm doing it my day job and it's near impossible to keep up with everything as you're doing your day job. So by inviting the tech leaders, these are the ones, you know, like at Databricks, we have a plan. We just had our kickoff. The next many quarters are our product pipeline. So we know in advance, and our partners, we share information. What does Microsoft and Apple and everyone, what are they doing? So it's good to have tech leaders involved in Washington and or internationally, wherever the government agencies are, so they can appraise them in 6 months from now. You're mentioning all the different maturity levels, LLM. One thing that might be next was like all these governance tools. Another that might be next is what's called the data intelligence platform, where it uses LLMs, which is like a type of Gen AI, to get information from your assets more than just a keyword search. So like more than just saying, did Sanjay use the word government? And it'll just blindly pull up. You could say, like, where does he emphasize government for security? And it understands the context. That's the data intelligence platform, better searching, better understanding. And that needs to be governed as well. Something called clean rooms is in marketplaces is a concept where you could share data among companies. You could also have this technique where, let's just say you're competitors. Every single credit card company in the world, you think they don't want to share data, but when it comes to the point where there are fraudulent people like doing scams and they try one credit card and then the next, it's beneficial for the whole industry to share data without sharing personal information. So you just have this abstract ID of some person or entity doing credit card fraud. They can share it, like the way casinos work in Vegas, so that you can't walk in and out of different casinos being a serial scammer. So that's one way you can collaborate. But yeah, these tech leaders know not only what's in the pipeline for future innovation. But you know, the other challenge is there's so much news coming out on AI. I was just at this retreat in the Bay Area that they're inundated with news on AI. They're inundated with vendors calling them up. And I'm sure legislators are in the same quandary. So if you talk to tech leaders, they can help short circuit of what's the summary, what technology is just hype and what are companies actually coding, actually moving to production versus theory.
Sorry, you made a very good point, but let me just ask your opinion. You talked about tech leaders talking to members of Congress. We just had a hearing about social media in the Senate sometime back. And the fear right now is that we only have a few tech leaders talking to members of Congress, and this will become another social media where our city square is dominated by a few companies. If we just have tech leaders and their lobbies whisper in the ears of members of Congress, do you think there is a possibility of monopoly or a regulatory capture? What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So in all different industries, through acquisition, just in companies acquired, consumer product goods, there's some very few companies that own hundreds of brands. So when you go to the grocery store, like 80, 90% of the products are from just five major companies. And that provides efficiency, but you're right. It could be like monopoly, duopoly, a handful of companies. And so, yeah, that does skew some tech leaders. Near unprecedented in history. There have been some precedents in the past from business. So that's one thing. And then the other is some of the large companies are making enough money that it's supporting their industry and less on innovation. And a lot of the innovation comes from people in the proverbial garage, 5-10 people. People, our founders at Databricks were, they all met at UC Berkeley, Stanford. I went to Caltech. And there's been a lot of companies that are just like students that don't have the ear, that haven't made the money yet, but the speed of the adoption could be incredible. You could go from 0 to 1 million downloads in just a month. But yeah, it is something that has to be balanced. I don't want to name names, but if you are a wealthy gazillionaire, yeah, you, whether it's intentional or unintentional, have your company or portfolio of companies' minds in there. So whether it's intentional or not, you could be persuading legislation towards the favor of your world. Hard to avoid. You still need that in there, but having a balance of other companies, not just for the power perspective, but a lot of the innovation are these small companies. They get success, then they get acquired. So those smaller agile companies need to be part of the discussion.
Now you make a very good point. And that's one of the things that we do in this platform is we bring in small companies, we bring in community colleges, we bring in academics, we bring in security experts, et cetera, because all perspectives are very relevant. It just can't be a few companies in Silicon Valley or a few universities on the coast. You mentioned something that there is a debate right now in the industry, open source versus closed source. You have potentially Meta with Llama, Llama 2, Llama 3, IBM. Then you have potentially OpenAI, Microsoft, closed source. Where do you come out because on this side?
Yeah, so I'm personally a big proponent of open source. It's something that I have a lot of hands-on experience. When I was with Oracle, I ended up being the president of the worldwide Oracle user group. Oracle started out with the opposite of open source is like proprietary vendor software. And they made a lot of money, but then open source became so big, a competitor, MySQL, was based on open source. Oracle ended up acquiring it. So when I was president, so I saw like the value of having a community contribute. That for the listeners who aren't as familiar, open source, it's like you get transparent, you can see what the code looks like, you can be a contributor, mostly as a volunteer, but it all has to do with transparency and community and everyone kind of chipping in together to make the solution better. Now that has become so popular that three technologies I've been close to, Apache Spark, MLflow, Delta Lake, they get hundreds of millions of downloads every month, over a billion combined per year, which is unbelievable. So if you're not familiar with that part of just how popular open source is, that's one eye opener. But the other is the transparency. Whatever it is now or in the future, if you're building an AI model, you're an individual, you're a company, you're just saying summarize something, it's called lineage. You want to understand where is the source of the data building into the model coming from? And that's where open source models are very helpful. So that's one thing. That's when you're just as an individual, write me an essay that does this, summarize these documents, or whether you're a business, you're a law firm, what were the precedents of this legal case of car accident in New Jersey where this and that happened? You need to not just understand where the data comes from, but how did these models synthesize the data to get what you want? So the more open that is, the more reliable the insights are, and the more people trust that the models either are accurate or they trust they're not accurate and they can tweak it, called fine-tuning or ragging it. So big proponent of open source.
Big proponent. Ari, we've had some guests come here and say that we have either nation states or non-nation states who are maybe not as friendly, don't have our values. We are giving them, let's say, this technology with its weights and everything else, and we are putting it in the hands of some of our enemies, whether it's bioterrorism or things of that nature. What is your perspective on what their view is in terms of why they should, we should not open source this?
So first of all, that is one of the biggest things that keeps me up all night is you have other countries, like take HIPAA laws, for example. We need and we do protect like medical information. There are other countries or other groups that don't adhere to that. So they have, unfortunately, an advantage where they could take data, find people, they can do things to or identify people in their territory or under their control. Or when I say attack, whether it's information or disclosing or doxing or physically tracking people, that's a challenge when you have other people that don't adhere to the same ethics or limitations as you do. In terms of open source, yeah, open source makes things transparent, but I think the bad actors, so to speak, are, you can't really stop them in that regards. So open source, I think, will do more good than harm. It'll be good for everyone.
Okay. Ari, the EU Act is basically kind of an horizontal piece of legislation. Do you think when you look at the US, that is there a need for industry-specific AI regulation, or should it be broadly applicable across different sectors?
Yes, a little bit of both. So they're fundamentally across all sectors. If you use a model, linear regression or Gen AI or gradient boosted trees, that model at one certain level doesn't care what industry you're in. From that perspective, yeah, you want regulations or governance or access control into making sure information's not leaked. So one example is just privacy information, making sure social security numbers don't get out. There are provisions that you can hide within a database that social security numbers get transformed into hashtag, 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 dash, et cetera. So people don't actually see it unless they're allowed to. But when you do a model and you make a model and social security is part of it, you need regulation. The same regulation that deals with the raw data needs to make sure along as you move downstream to the next stage, the grouping of information, that it does not reveal any privacy information. Or at the tail end, when you have a large language model, I could ask it, how much salary does Sanjay make? And it might be in the database and it might just give me your salary, but that's not what you want. Where if you do it just a pure database, it'll say access denied for the salary. That, you know, that's called leakage. Something that has to be horizontal, but then for each industry, there are certain like complexities or innuendos. In medical, there's HIPAA. In retail, there's credit card transactions. In government, there could be contracts. So number one, you need governance to see who has access to what. You need governance to see how are models being built, what's the algorithms, what in that lineage is like, where are all the data sources that roll into it upstream, and then downstream, where does it get distributed? Once the model's in production, can you go to a website if you're not an employee and access that? But yeah, every industry, even gaming industry, was at the gaming conference, GPC, and they have things like toxicity, or how do you match players? The toxicity meaning people cursing, people saying racist things in near real time. That's an industry specific. Same thing on social media we're talking about. Every social media platform should have some, you know, standard toxic or some flag if information is actually true or not. And that those are all industry specific. Manufacturing, public, private sector, education, each has their own various domains that should be governed.
So you're proposing like a hybrid model, Gary?
Exactly. Some for each. If an industry already has some regulation, it has to be extended to an equal, if not greater degree on AI. But then, yeah, overall, you don't want a company to claim, oh, we're not really manufacturing, we're a technology company. You still want them to adhere to that horizontally.
Because there are existing laws, like you can't discriminate in terms of hiring, whether you use AI or not. You can't discriminate in terms of housing, whether you use AI or not. And in terms of consumers, we have FTC, et cetera. But what you're saying is on top of it, there should be an overall regulation to protect also.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Exactly, and that hiring thing is a great example. I've worked with some HR firms where it's positive in both ways. You don't want to literally intentionally enable discrimination. And that one person who was fully inspired, since he put these from the American perspective, he had an international name, and he changed his name on his resume to, as an experiment, Paul or David, and the exact same everything else. And he would get interviews significantly higher. So that was unfair. That's actual discrimination. But then again, like looking at resumes is a challenge, since you put the word like Python in there, and you don't know if they just took a class and don't know how to program, or if they're truly an expert, and there's no way to differentiate that. But LLMs can find complexities on how they phrase things, could even, like during a tech interview, help look at transcripts and guide through it. But from the positive standpoint, not only do you want things fair for the candidates, but for the people employing, you want them to get great, a better fit as well without that filtering. So they're looking for ways to improve things as well. But yeah, from the HR standpoint, which could be HR software, which is a vertical, or every company that has an HR department horizontally, how do you detect bias? How do you report it? How do you avoid it? What does it mean? Is there a certain threshold where it's okay, or is no tolerance? All of that is more on the legislation aspect of it.
So let's talk a little bit about workforce and employment. Two aspects of it. Just maybe a few weeks, about a month or so ago, right before Davos, IMF came out saying, hey, up to 60% jobs could be at risk in developing countries, maybe 40% in developing countries. Take the number 40, 60. That's a very large number of people that could be displaced. So that's one aspect. The other aspect, obviously, is there, and President Biden's executive order talks about this, and he also talks about it from an immigration standpoint, is that we need to get the best and the brightest because we have a skills gap in ensuring AI workforce. What role do you think legislation can play in terms of, firstly, the displacement of workers, and secondly, obviously, filling in the gaps for the tech industry, the government, et cetera. So if you can address both those issues, because we have some major changes that are going to be coming in front of us.
Exactly. So that's another point that keeps me up at night, a couple hours for each of these challenges. But automation, Virgil, I think automation, where automation of time-consuming, repetitive tasks is something throughout history that like has progressed humanity forward. So the automation, you can get better efficiencies, you can get better different technologies, you could put people on the moon, you can improve medical care to levels that have been unseen. So that automation, I think, is great. The challenge is when it happens so fast that unemployment could skyrocket. Yeah, I think it's, I'm a little less, like, than 60% is in the farther future, but in the coming years, it figures I've seen is about 30% of a lot of work could realistically be automated. And that, yeah, possibly more so in the developing worlds. So that's like all over the place. So that's one thing, but overall, you would hope that people just shift their responsibilities, level up. In the IT world alone, we're now seeing automation of coding in Python, SQL, R. Like, I have kids that, one's in college, two are going in, and they're like, what programming language should I take? And it's a big question, since by the time they get out in 4 years, a lot of what's happening will be automated, but it's still good to get a grounding in data, math, probability, statistics, business analysis, critical thinking. So that's one thing. And then to your question, what can government do from the U.S. perspective? I've been seeing this for many decades, but there's two things. There's one, people who are not yet in America, and this is an American perspective. You could replace this with other countries and from their perspective, but you want people who are not yet here to make it easier to get a visa, to get a work permit. You want to make it easier to have that path to citizenship, to attract them, not just temporarily, but permanently. That immigrant mentality is what made America, you know, great and continues to. Work visas, having a pathway for citizenship. And then there's also government itself hiring. At this retreat, I was at a Battery Ventures retreat. The two biggest venture funding that's happening is AI and cybersecurity. How do you manage all these risks? And the government has a significant number already of job openings in cybersecurity. It's a big risk. It's a critical, important part of our national defense. But yeah, having the government ensure that we are hiring people domestically and internationally, there's such a gap there. That's another way the government can help facilitate that, is with the jobs itself. And then the other thing is just maybe having government think tanks. There's government policy that could be influenced by these, and you'll get the best and brightest globally. And maybe that might foster partnership with local companies, which kind of is a virtuous cycle where they hear of job opportunities, get visas, extend the visas, make it easier, that process, extend the number of visas we can have for certain types of workers.
So Ari, if I may follow up, you brought up several points, and we've had some education experts and we've had this discussion. So you said 30%. Now, one side, we are saying 30% people get displaced. And remember, unlike in the past, these are going to be white collar jobs. And you just talked about your kids, telling them what should they learn. So far, historically, we've been telling all our kids, learn STEM. Now comes GitHub Copilot and others. Do you think we need a little bit of a shift, because it's maybe the liberal arts also is important, because you need some creative thinking besides knowing how to code and things of that nature? So that's one question. How do we reskill this 30% or whatever the number you think is going to be out there? Because when you tell 30% of these people, open the visa, let people come in because we need these, give them citizenship, That's a hard argument, especially in Washington, to make.
Yeah, and I'm a big supporter of the arts as well. That is going to be fascinating to watch, too, since there's just that strike in Hollywood, movies, television, and that the technology isn't fully caught up, but the ability to write some scripts that might be good enough, to make movies that might be good enough, is going to be interesting. There is always some element. My son is a champion chess player. And yes, you can get a computer to two computers to play each other, but nobody cares. They want to, even though a computer could be better, they still want to see that human competition, the human spirit. That's why sports and entertainment is going to continue to be big. And yeah, I'm a big proponent of STEM, but the point of just being like a beginning level Python programmer is going to be automated. But I still want STEM. STEM to me is biology. It's helping with resource management. Could be one step aside from that, supply chain and logistics. How do we feed and support a growing population? How do we change supply chain when some aspects of manufacturing are going to be shifting? And with STEM, I think it just goes from like the simple coding, which you mentioned Copilot, there's others where you could literally just, I do it now, right now, just write a Python program that uploads this data, does this, pivots and does a graph, and it does a pretty good job. It might have to tweak it, but you are always going to need business people who know how to collaborate, ask business questions, get information, and help businesses actually take action. So yeah, maybe more advanced STEM and like business degrees or leadership degrees. And then 10 years from now, all bets are off.
10 years, all bets are off. So that leads me to the question as to, Ari, what do you see as the biggest risk from AI that needs to be regulated?
Yeah, AI is a broad spectrum. I break it into two parts. One is traditional AI, and one is like the newer generative AI. So traditional AI is you have existing data. You mentioned multimodal. So that could, what that means is structured data. It could be video, images, Word docs, PDFs. That's how do you make predictions, something in the future based on in the past, or classification. This customer is likely to churn or not. And that needs all the regulations that we talked about on this episode. Then there's Gen AI, which could be content creation. The big risk there and the role government can play is like intellectual property. We're already seeing that you write a paper, like humans plagiarize intentionally, unintentionally. But this could be like sources where the AI doesn't know if it's real, based in reality or not, if it's fantasy or not. You could have bad actors intentionally. You could have normal people unintentionally. So you just don't know what is truth. And these LLMs just create information based on either what it's fed or what it somehow web crawled. So that is, I think, like the most important thing is to figure out what is truth and what is not. If it's generated like art or it has a basis of some intellectual property, I don't know if it would be a watermark or some digital signature to give credit to the like the original authors, to have as equal, if not better, IP protection than just raw data has. It's even, I think, more so in generative AI, since these are either open or closed, but you're having millions and soon hundreds of millions of people that are going to be making decisions, and you need to credit and have IP protection just to keep society together.
Yeah. So you said whether it's truth or not truth. So let's say if an AI system is not telling the truth or causes some harm, who should be held liable? The developer, the deployer, or the user, or all?
Great question. And yeah, I would say sound like a lawyer, but it depends. But there's a workflow. There's like a process that it takes to get a model deployed. And the blame or the responsibility, probably every step of the way, all the above. But when you have raw data, all the way to when you ingest data, transform data, do the actual model, have a human evaluate if that model is good enough or that it needs tweaking. And then once the model's deployed, the world changes, new data comes in. It's called data drift or model drift. Who's responsible for changing it? Or whatever. So it has a model based on somebody, and then that person passes away or changes jobs, and it has outdated information. So there's that responsibility. Then there's the operationalizing. It's called ML ops or LLM ops. Who's responsible to swap in and out new models? So each step along the way, like maybe who's responsible legally goes up or down. So the actual workers should bear some responsibility. Like it's your job if you're air traffic controller to get the planes in safely. But at the other point, you need the FAA in this case, or if it's some private company, they're responsible and they should be responsible for putting measures in place, for putting training in place to make sure that the people touching any step of the way understand the ramifications, they get training on detection. It's also the company's responsibility, in my opinion, to have observability, a dashboard of the air traffic control again. Where are all the moving pieces? What's being adhered to? What's not? Where's the data being biased? Where is it not? Where is there an outlier or malfunction? You have somebody left the company. Are they prohibited from taking like model intelligence with them? So ultimately, it should be legally responsible for the companies to ensure a correct level of governance and like auditing. Can they trace who did what when? But then there's a certain degree responsibility of the individual as well.
Yeah. So it obviously, as you said, it will depend on the circumstances at that point. Ari, should companies have a legal duty to disclose when AI is being used by them?
Great question. I was asked that once before. So the challenge is AI is such a broad thing that everything that's data has some form of AI involved. So that would basically, it'd be a challenge. Everywhere you'd see would say, we're using Zoom as AI for transcribing and summarizing things. But there should be when there's anti-plagiarism. Whenever you're sourcing a quote from somebody, or you're sourcing an original image or a photograph, something with intellectual property, yes, you should have to disclose that. Then the question for me, which I'm curious how the governments around the world will solve it, is there's a spectrum of when you start generating content, like Photoshop. You can have a photo, but if you do like Sports Illustrated, I think got not in trouble, but got like some opinions when they would augment some of their photos, or Cosmopolitan. So there would be like, it's based on a real photo, but it could be 10% modified by Photoshop or 10% modified by AI. What that threshold is, I don't know. Maybe it's zero. Maybe you just say this image was modified by AI. So maybe it's zero, but at some point, if it's fully generated image, then yeah, absolutely, I'd want to know AI generated photograph.
Well, that's very helpful. Ari, as I told you up front, we have viewers on the Hill, members of Congress, Senate, think tanks, the staff, corporates, advocacy groups. Final perspective from you to them as they work towards legislation, whether it's at state level, federal level, this is your time.
Great. Well, first, thank you for the service that you're doing for our country and then for internationally, respective over there, greatly appreciated by a lot of people. I guess the advice is things are changing so quickly to keep getting think tanks, keep searching out new people, cycling in new leadership to get a variety. So you want to understand how businesses are actually implementing or thinking of implementing newer technologies. You want business leaders, both the few major companies, but then business leaders that also represent medium and small companies. Also, education is a big part. So yeah, just be involved, involve others, ask questions. I'm on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me as well. I try to be as transparent as I can, but yeah, have to keep up constantly learning, since 6 months from now, there is going to be a whole new set of like tools and platforms out there, 12 months again. So always be curious, always be learning, ask questions if you don't understand something, and good luck.
Great advice. Be quick, always ask questions, always be learning. That's great advice for our listeners. Ari, thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule. This was very informative, very helpful. Really appreciate it.
Well, Sanjay, thank you so much. And thanks to all the listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.